a new topic on the grounds of what we saw so far. So I would like to take some questions about this little tour de force that we did in the past three or four lectures. So do you have any questions about Libby-Robinson bounds or the clustering of correlations? Yes?
Yeah, in the Libby-Robinson bound, there's a parameter of alpha. Right?
Yeah.
We think the alpha need not to be larger than 1, but only be positive.
Correct. It's a typo.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, alpha just needs to be positive. Yes, correct. And this parameter is free, means that the bound is true for every alpha. Then depending on R, you can just find the optimal value of alpha by minimizing this function. So the optimal value of this is not for alpha small, but alpha around 2. It also depends on R, of course.
Why do you need to minimize this function?
What I mean is that, so you have a bound for every value of alpha, but this bound can be tighter or looser. And it is tighter if you minimize this number.
So does this function indeed affect some property of alpha?
No. No, so Libby-Robinson bound is an upper bound. You can make it a bit tighter by working on alpha, but that's not a very important point because the Libby-Robinson bounds are a bit loose. And I already argued why they're loose, for instance, right? Because there are two main sources of looseness. The first one is that you get the highest of all the coupling constants, and you say, oh, the speed can at most be proportional to the largest of all of them. Whereas, I mean, this is a very crude bound. It's a correct bound, but it's very crude. One could do better. In some cases, we need to do better. So depending on the system, we can do the proof in a different way. That's why I talk about Libby-Robinson bounds. There are many theorems that can be adapted. The second source of crudeness or in this approximation is that, so if you remember the proof, we are saying that this commutator between A, T, and B is a sum of many, many terms, and these terms are the paths between A and B. And so imagine, for instance, we are computing the expectation value of this commutator. It will be the sum over all these numbers that are complex numbers. However, we take the norm, and so by taking the norm and using the triangular inequality, we do an upper bound. We are safe, but then they can never cancel, right? We always do the worst possible scenario that is always constructive interference, but this is generically not true. So we do make an upper bound. It's just a crude upper bound. But you know, even a crude upper bound gives us the exponential scaling, and this is enough to prove that you can approximate and make a smaller error, as a very small error. The fact that the bound is loose means that the real error is actually even smaller. Right? Yeah, so I'm saying I am upper bounding you with a number that I can show is very, very small. Then you are happy because then you can use your approximations and say, hey, my error is very small, it's exponentially small. The bound being loose means that the actual error is even smaller. You had the question, yeah.
Just like the Libby-Robinson bound is associated with operator growth, if I understand correctly, there's also bounds and velocities associated with the spread of entanglement. So I was just wondering if there's a relationship between the two, or are they independent?
No, they are very related. So one can use the Lieber-Robinson bounds to also give a bound to the velocity of spread of all correlations. There is a section in the notes where they prove how correlations spread, and a similar bound holds for the entanglement.
Just the entanglement will have to do with the states of the theory, whereas the Robinson bound was purely a bound on the operators. And so a priori there isn't... Like...
Okay, so if you read this section, you will see that we use the bound on the operators to derive a bound on the correlation functions. Okay, now, so correlation functions are about the state.
Right.
And now, you know, entanglement is a form of correlation. It can be reconstructed if you have access to all the correlation functions, you can reconstruct the entanglement. So this is just to convince you that you can do similar proofs for the spread of entanglement. Other questions? Okay, so let's review the very important things that we understood prior to now. So about the situation that we call symmetry breaking. So when we have the symmetry breaking means that we have a Hamiltonian and the symmetry, which is a global symmetry. So let me write it. T is a global symmetry. This is very important. And what is this symmetry? For instance, in the case study that we have, that we know everything about, T is the product on all the sides of sigma x j. See, it's a global operator. And now symmetry breaking means that given a Hamiltonian depends on parameters, for some range of the parameters, say smaller than some critical lambda, I think in the case study we did like this, greater than a critical lambda, then the ground state is unique. Which is equivalent to saying that psi 0 commutes with your symmetry. And because there is a gap, now we know what this means. We saw it in the quantum XY model, but now we know it in general. There must be a finite correlation length. Right? Okay. So we know that if we are in the symmetry broken phase, this theorem fails. Right? We saw it at the end of last lecture. So what happens when you have lambda smaller than lambda c? Then you have degeneracy in the ground state. So this means that, for instance, your sempli grazia, your ground state manifold for the Z2 symmetry breaking, are all the linear combinations of these two states, all spins up and all spins down, all spins down. All the linear combinations of this. So you see, this is a specific basis. I could choose another basis. I could have chosen also this basis. Let me call it the collective plus and the collective minus. Well, no. Well, let me write it like this. I hope it's clear what I mean. These are two states, right? So this is also a basis with two states, right? One with the plus and one with the minus. Is this clear? Okay. So as a linear space, this space is the same of this space. There is a difference in the basis that so what property does this basis have with respect to this basis? I call these two states phi plus and phi minus.
It's not eigenstate of any local operator.
That's a very interesting point, but the property that right now we're interested in is that these states do not commute with t.
Obvious.
So they break the symmetry, whereas these states do not break the symmetry. They are the completely symmetric and a completely anti-symmetric state. And these are unique in the sense that every other linear combination breaks the symmetry. However, these ones are those that maximally break the symmetry, remember? This means that, so not only you have that they do not commute, so let me write it in this form. See, I can connect one with the other. But also, if I take the density matrix, so this will not commute, but this norm is the max over the ground state manifold. Okay. So we know that if there is a degeneracy, then clustering theorem doesn't work. And in fact, we learned even before knowing the clustering theorem that if I take a state like a phi plus, correlation functions like this go like some function of lambda. Remember? They do not decay with the distance between I and J. This is what we call long range order. And we also know that if I take the order parameter, which is some operator that breaks the symmetry, like this, the expectation value of this object in general also is, so for psi in lambda, say zero in lambda, is different from zero. This is what is called spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay. So some comment is in order here. So what makes it spontaneous? So what makes it spontaneous is that, because you see, it depends on where I take this expectation value. Because if I take the expectation value in the symmetric states, it's zero. In a symmetric state, there is no symmetric break. But sigma z at the site I sees the difference between this state and this state. In here, I have plus one, and here I have minus one. That's why I say it's different from zero. So now we have a question, and we say that this is what happens. So we say that spontaneously, we will not find the system in these symmetric superpositions. Now, you see, this is a statement that has nothing to do with this math. It's a new statement. We are saying that there must be some physical reason such that the system chooses not to be in the symmetric states. Always wants to break the symmetry. So this is what makes it spontaneous. And we need to explain that. Remember, I owe you that. So this explanation is not in this math. So quantum mechanics is linear, which means that you cannot prefer a basis over another basis unless this preference. So there is only one, although very important, case in which you can prefer a basis over another basis in quantum mechanics. What is this case?
Measurement.
Measurement. Measurement, there is a preference. I choose to measure in this basis. In fact, this is not linear. Right? You select one possible direction which to make a measurement, one basis, which is the eigenbasis of the operator that you are measuring. So as long as you just have your Hamiltonian, your Hilbert space, there cannot be any preference. So if we want to argue that this basis is somehow preferred, we cannot have the system as an isolated system. It must be a system that is interacting with an environment. Okay? And then the environment is somehow selecting the basis. So the way we can understand this is by considering to cast this problem in a problem of stability. So just like if you have an isolated system, the two solutions of, for instance, in mechanics, you may have two equilibrium solutions for a differential equation, like like a pendulum. This is an equilibrium position. This is also an equilibrium position, but you know that this one is stable because under small perturbations stays there. And this is one is unstable because under small perturbations goes into the other one. But you have perturbations, right? You must make the system interact. So here we have something similar. And let's see what is the difference, because this is really about the interplay between global and local. OK. So I want to argue that these states can be more stable than these states. These states can be more stable than these states. And notice that what makes these states not stable, so what makes one state going to the other state, is this operator. So in order for your perturbation, your environment, to have this transition happen, your environment has to do T. Whereas, if I want to do between phi plus and phi minus, any sigma z at the site I will suffice. If your environment touches one spin, I change the phase. And changing the phase means going from phi plus to phi minus. So you see, this is what breaks the symmetry. That this process is global, and this other process is local. So you can understand why this process it's very likely to happen. Just if I am perturbing the system, and I do not put some constraint on the interaction, then I touch one spin and I tunnel, so this makes it fragile. On the other hand, now here when this is global, now we don't know, right? Now this is complicated. One thing we know is that the interactions with the environment are local. So it is not immediate to know whether these local interactions can effectively summon a process of the type T or not. It does depend on the circumstances, but it is not immediately fragile. In fact, it does depend on the interplay between how much energy and how much entropy are created, in other words, in the free energy of this process. Okay? So in classical statistical mechanics, you have learned that this is just, you can see this as a classical process, right? This is a product state, so all spins up. What is the probability that they all flip to all spins down? You know that below a certain critical temperature, this is forbidden. I will come to your questions, all of you. And above a critical temperature, this wants to happen. And you know that this critical temperature depends on many things, including the dimensionality of the system. For instance, for a chain, there is no finite T. Only at t equals 0. Okay, but now you see, so let's take, for instance, the case of the 2D Ising model. You know that there is a critical temperature. Below the critical temperature, you get stuck in the sector with positive magnetization. So these states are long-lived, they're stable. But when we look at the quantum case, when we have superpositions, then these operators locally make you flip from one state to the other state. So this must be fragile. This is what makes this symmetry breaking spontaneous. And then from now on, we can say that the symmetry breaking is spontaneous if the order operator, so the operator that is taking a value that is different from zero is local. And having a local order operator is a consequence of having a global symmetry. See, it's having a global symmetry that shows you that in the basis of that symmetry, something happens, and in the other basis, it must be local because it becomes a phase. Okay, so now I'll take. But you had a question, right? Yeah.
We could similarly argue that if sigma I at x would be a local perturbation which can destroy the zero state.
So sigma x.
Sigma z's are all places. We can just flip the argument by introducing appropriate operator.
Yes, you could. you could, I mean, this is an extremely clever question. You mathematically, you can flip the argument, right? So this would mean, this would mean that I have another Hamiltonian, which instead of being zz plus x, is xx plus z. In this case, the global operator is this. Is this what you mean?
I mean, I'm not even talking about the Hamiltonian, because in this case, the perturbation is completely independent of the Hamiltonian. So we can equally likely have a perturbation.
No. This does depend on the Hamiltonian. This must be, this T must be the symmetry of the Hamiltonian.
As I understand the two operations that we introduced in this final argument, they are just perturbations from the environment, and the environment should not be concerned about the symmetries of the Hamiltonian.
No, this is correct. So all I'm saying is that this is the spontaneous symmetry breaking of the ground state of a given Hamiltonian. So, but if you are just preparing the states, okay, not as the ground state of an Hamiltonian, then what you say applies, of course. Also, if I am in the X basis, so if 0 and 1 are the eigenstates of sigma X, in that case, also this one would be fragile in the basis of sigma X. And now the operator T would be a product of all sigma z's. Sure.
I'm still confused. I still don't see why one basis is preferred over the other.
So I'm not sure I understand the question. You don't see the preference between x and z, or between this and this?
Between these two. Like, why would the symmetry broken state prefer to go into zero?
So the reason is here. The reason is that if you have a global operator, okay, then this global operator has, there are two states such that in that basis, this global operator has non-vanishing off-diagonal matrix elements. Okay? So what I'm saying is that T is global, then there is a basis that is this one basis in which T has this form. Okay? But then there is another basis such that something, let me call it just sigma, which is local. So this implies that there is another basis such that a local operator has this form. So it's the global symmetry. So given the global symmetry, which is given once you give the Hamiltonian, then this selects the basis in which there is a local operator that has non-vanishing of diagonal elements.
I see that, but I just don't get why the noise has to care about the symmetries of the Hamiltonian. I mean, the system could be interacting with any kind
of... No, the noise can do... That's correct. The noise can operate with any operator you want. It can operate with the sigma z, with the sigma x, okay? All I'm saying is that when the noise operates with sigma z, then it's able to do this. The point is that why when... The noise must be local, okay? This is a rule of the game, because interactions are local. And so the noise doesn't care about the symmetries of the Hamiltonian. All the noise knows is that it is local. So it can operate on a single spin with the identity, with sigma x, with sigma y, with sigma z, or any linear combination of these. And this is all that you can do on a spin, because that's the algebra of the Hermitian operators on that spin, okay? Now, the point is, how do states behave under this noise? Okay, so now say that the states that you're looking at are the span of these two states, or of these two states is the same, okay? What I'm saying is that these two bases are not equivalent, because under this noise, these bases may be robust, because in order to have this process, you have to do a global operation. Whereas this basis is necessarily fragile.
Sir, what do you mean by robust? Because
robust means that if I do the calculation, so I take my system, I put it in an environment. The environment has a given temperature, and I try to compute the lifetime of this state. If there is a critical temperature, below that critical temperature, the lifetime of the state is infinite in the thermodynamic limit. So in this sense, it's robust.
I think the real question is that why can we put the perturbation operator as a sigma ix? Then sigma ix will destroy the zero state.
The sigma?
Ix.
Sure, but it will not make you tunnel here.
Yeah, I mean, why do we restrict ourselves that the perturbation must preserve the state to be ground state? We can put the ground state to be any excitation state, right?
Oh no, I understand. It's the problem of stability. Here you have it's this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's the problem of stability. If you have two minima, okay, so you just excite a little bit here. Then, if this is stable, if this barrier is high, then with the equal probability, you will go back to here. On average, you are here.
I see.
So this is stable.
We must.
But
ground state.
But if this barrier is low, then when you excite locally, you get to the other one, which is exactly what I'm saying here. So what I'm arguing is that if this process is local, then the height of this barrier can only depend on the macroscopic detail of the models, that are the coupling constants and the temperature, which are what they are. However, when this is global, the process is global, then this height may depend on the size of the system, which I'm sure you've done in statistical mechanics. I can go over the argument again if you want. What do you want? You want me to go on with the course? Or I can do this for you now, right now, if you like.
I'm good now. So if my understanding right is that after the perturbation, the state should also be the ground state, right? We should now excite this.
Yeah, so these problems of stability are looking to the minima, right? So you know your state will be the minimum most of the time. So the problem is not the excitations, it's whether you go to the other minimum or not. So if you go to this minimum and then you go back to this minimum, if this flipping comes all the time, then in the end, you can only be in a mixed state, that this is the mixed state of all zero and all ones. So that's why you cannot preserve a superposition. If you want to, if you read the paper by Zurek on the coherence, the original paper by Zurek, there is a very long discussion that somehow summarizes what I sketched here. The reason why one basis is selected over all the possible bases.
Sorry, the preference to be at exactly the minimum is actually controlled by our temperature selection, which is totally irrelevant with our spin flipping because it's controlled by our external field. So we can all here, we can always choose our temperature to be absolute zero.
No, what the temperature does, the temperature tells you what is the strength of the kick. So the temperature, together with this height, determine whether you go over this or not. So the temperature, technically, is just the probability of interacting with the system at a given energy. Because what is the probability, what is the temperature is this, right? This is the environment. So it's telling you what is the probability of having the environment populated at a given level. So this is the probability for the environment having energy E.
So actually, it's basically impossible to get to any excited states. I think that also can argue for.
No. It's not important. It does depend on the temperature. No. That's when you thermalize with the environment, it means that you will have the same beta. So it means that your system with this probability will be in this excited state. The problem is what happens when beta is infinite. So when you, in the ground state, right? We are talking about the ground state, so for zero temperature.
Yeah, so zero temperature can actually resolve the problem. Why don't we choose excitation? Because it's at zero temperature and it has nothing to do with our external field. So we can just don't consider the any excitations. Just consider the ground states, right?
Okay, so you want to know, but you still want to perturb the system, right? So you means you put in touch with an environment with a very large beta, and then you freeze the system again. Right? And you want to see where you land. Do you stay stuck here, or you mix the two sectors? This is the question. And in statistical mechanics, in fact, you don't even care, strictly speaking, about zero temperature, just temperature below the critical value, which means that, yes, you have excitations, but all these excitations live in the sector of positive magnetization. So the point is M, which is just the sum of a sigma, and now there is a loss of generality in writing like this. What you care is that this takes a value different from zero. So in the ground state, it would be exactly one. If you introduce excitations, it depends. So if you only introduce excitations that are around this minimum, then they're all positive. They're not one, but they're all positive. And so this explains this diagram. So this is one. At zero temperature, you do not have excitations. All spins are up. Now you start introducing excitations, but you still have a residual magnetization. But once you go above TC, you explore as many configurations with the majority of spins up as configurations with majority of spin down, and then the average cannot be but zero, independent of your initial conditions. Because the sectors mix, everything is ergodic. Below the critical temperature, you are stuck in one sector of your phase space where the spins have a majority of up. So when you average in there, you get something that is different from zero. So this is the spontaneous symmetry breaking. And you see, it depends on the initial conditions. You are stuck where you were, which is exactly my argument of stability. You are stuck in that sector. Now, if you go back to the quantum case and say, imagine that I have a noise model. So now I don't summon temperature. Okay, I'm zero temperature. I must be in the ground state. I have a noise model. So this means that because I'm always at zero temperature, I know eventually I will be in the ground space. I will be in L. But will I make this type of errors or not? Well, that depends, right? But it's not guaranteed that I make this type of errors. Here, I will make them all the time. So I mix the sectors. You can use the temperature as a way of saying, oh, what is the probability of having a kick at a certain energy, of creating excitations. But then in the end, you freeze your system again and you go to the ground state. Okay. If you want, we can talk more about this. I hope that at the very least I've convinced you that these states are connected by local operator, whereas those states are connected by a global operator. So if you only look at that process, you can understand why one of these, why there is no symmetry between these two operations. Then what is the physical model that implements it? You know, can be it is actually a very complicated topic. That's why, you know, I just wave my hands. I try to give you a cartoon of this. Okay. So now the question is, okay, so let me go back to that long range order. You see, the long range order happens when I take the expectation value in phi plus. Why? Because now I can connect in phi plus the two states by means of local operators. Remember the proof that we did yesterday? If I can connect them, then that proof fails. When I sum over those ai0, b0i, then I have another state that is at the same energy, and I have something of order one that I cannot say it's small. So people thought, in fact, they thought about it with the hindsight, but people started thinking of it in a different way earlier, is what if I have a system in which I have a symmetry that is not spontaneously broken? Imagine that I have different ground states, but they cannot be connected by local operators. So how can I obtain a system like that? And so this is the topic of today, and this is the quantum gauge theory. So you see, this is very, really beautiful, because suddenly this topic connects to a completely different topic, that is gauge theories in quantum mechanics. And let me also put in parentheses, lattice. We will do everything on a lattice, because that's where we have developed all our technology, you know, Lib-Robinson bounds, locality, all these things. So let's try to review what is a gauge theory in quantum mechanics, because it's different from classical physics. So what is a gauge theory in quantum mechanics? Something that is more strictly defined with respect to classical physics. So let me give you an example. It is an example that I think I summoned quickly in the first lecture. So imagine that we have a particle on a straight line. Okay. So we want to describe in quantum mechanics a particle on a straight line. The Hilbert space of this system might be described by, I can give a, for every position of the particle, so I can use the position basis to describe my, so I will have the linear combinations of these basis states for every position of the particle. Okay, so this is the Hilbert space. Now consider, I can write many Hamiltonians that must be local operators on this Hilbert space. Imagine I have this one. This is kinetic energy. Here I have coupling constant. Okay. This is a periodic potential. At the position x, I see the potential v cosine 2 pi x over a. As you can see, this potential is periodic, right? It's periodic in a, in x, sorry. This is the value a. Right? When x is equal to a, I have again the same potential as before. So now consider the translation operator. So translating by a quantity y is defined in this way. So now you see that there is a particular translation, TA, such that translates my particle, say, from here to here at the distance A, right? And of course, this particle will experience the same potential. So it will have the same energy. So it's not surprising that TA commutes with the Hamiltonian. And this is what we call a symmetry. So I'm sorry I'm talking about quantum physics 101, but in a second it will become more complicated. Okay? Okay, so this is a symmetry. We know what it means. It means that the states x and the states x plus a, so this transformation brings one state with a given energy to another state with the same energy. Okay? Have the same energy. Question, am I free to write another Hamiltonian for this system? Can I change this energy in a way that does not commute with the TA? Why not? Right? Why not? I can put any energy I want. So if I have a different H prime, then okay, I change the energy. Now Ta is not a symmetry of the system. Well, I change the energy, of course. Okay. Now imagine I describe a particle on a circle. Of length of circumference 2 pi a. Sorry, oh, the other way around. Of circumference a. So you see that if I have my particle here at x, then I associate a state x. What happens when the label is x plus a? Then I have to associate with the state x plus a. However, on a circle, I'm not describing the circle by all the x's belonging to R, right? But all the x's mod a. It's a compact variable with x. X is in R, but the circle is x mod a. So this means that the states x are also identified mod A. We have an equivalence class, right? So x is identified with x plus A because it's the same point on the circle. So the Hilbert space is the space of x plus Ka with x in R and k in N. There's nothing mysterious here. It's just the fact we are describing a circle and we need a compact variable. Having a compact variable means that if we have this variable x that is not compact, we need to compactify. And so we need to make an equivalence classes for every, we identify the states x and x plus ka. So now what happens to Ta on x? This is by definition x plus a, which is x. So you see that the Ta is not a transformation. Is just a transformation between the labels. It's a do-nothing transformation. Ta inside this Hilbert space is the identity. Inside this Hilbert space does something non-trivial. But here, this is not even a transformation. Do-nothing. So this structure in which you identify states is called the gauge structure, and the Hilbert space is called gauge, H gauge. So this is a gauge structure. Now question, can I write on this Hilbert space a Hamiltonian H prime that does not commute with Ta? Can I choose some Hamiltonian that does this? No. Right? Why not? Because if psi is in H gauge, and this is different from zero, then H on psi is not in H gauge anymore. So this is not a linear operator on H gauge. It takes me out of H gauge. So you see the gauge structure constrains the Hamiltonian to be gauge invariant. This is what you call a gauge transformation. But it's not a transformation, it's the structure that the Hilbert space has. And of course, the Hamiltonian must be compatible with the gauge structure. Otherwise, you simply do not have an operator on the Hilbert space. So you see, the gauge structure is in some sense something very simple and silly. It has to do with the fact that we use many labels for the same states, and then whatever operators has to operate on the Hilbert space in which we have identified the labels must respect that structure, which mathematically is encoded in, if this is the transformation between the labels that we identify, then the Hamiltonian or any other operator has to commute with it. Okay. So this was a very simple example. Now, in the 70s, people thought, can I do something like the Ising model? So I have a spins one half and a lattice. Let me use the square lattice is the clearest example. Of course, you can write the Ising model on a square lattice, in which you would have sigma z, not only in these directions, but also in these directions. And people were thinking, can I do a gauge theory? And what they meant was, I want a transformation so in these variables, in the variables that I have here, and then I identify them. I do this sort of compactification. Okay? And I want also these transformations to be local. Okay? So for every point in my lattice, I want to define a transformation between labels that I will identify, and this will be my gauge structure. Okay, so let's do that. So we will place the spins. Yes?
2 minutes left.
Okay, 2 minutes. We will place the spins on the bonds of this lattice, okay? So at every bond, we have C2, which means the span of two states. And let this be L by L lattice. So how many sites do we have?
Square.
N square. Sorry, L square. The number of sites.
2L square. Only sites or bonds.
The number of sites. It will be L square. Okay. Now, for the convenience of calculation, let's impose periodic boundary conditions. This means that I place my lattice on a torus. So if you want to look at the lattice, could be something like this, right? I don't draw all of it, just to make, okay. So what is the number of links?
2L
squared, great. So my total Hilbert space is the tensor product is C2, 12 times L squared, 2L squared, right? So these are my spins. Okay. Now I want to define a transformation that depends on the site. So this is the site. And I will label the sites by some variable. Let me call it n. Okay. So now I want to define a local transformation on h. And this transformation must depend on n. And I will say that this transformation is the transformation that acts like this. So this is the site n. These are the spins, right? Because the spins live here, right? And on each spin, I will act with the sigma x. In other words, if I am in the z basis, I'm flipping all the spins around the site n. Algebraically, we write it in this way. We call this operator the product on all the L that come out of the site n. So these links are labeled by L of sigma x. Okay, I'm done. Last thing. And then I will call, so this is my gauge transformation, right? So I take a state psi in H, and I operate with the transformation, and I obtain a state an psi. So I have flipped some spins. It's all I've done. So of course, in H, this state and this state are different, right? I flipped some spins. But now I will declare that H gauge are those states in H such that an psi is equal to psi. Those that are invariant, so identify them. So within H gauge, these two states are the same state, just like I did on the circle. On the circle, I said that H gauge was the states in H such that TAX is equal X. It's exactly the same thing I did before. So we didn't find it mysterious then, and mathematically it's the same thing. I'm identifying those states. So simple example, imagine that my state psi is all spins up. And now I operate with this operator here. This means that this, I get another state that is all up and down, 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 down. Does this state belong to H gauge? They're different states, right? So it would be interesting to understand what type of states are in here. Because it seems that no matter what I do, no matter what spin configuration I choose here, if I flip some, then I get a different state. So it cannot be an H gauge. Okay, so we'll see this tomorrow, what type of states, Monday, what type of states, okay? But so this is the structure of the simplest gauge theory we can write, and we continue Monday.